Hello, my name is Justin DeClue, and I'm here today with
Will Sloan,
and you're listening to the Important Cinema Club. And today, this one goes out to the dads out there, because we're talking about Kevin Costner, the director. Let's be very specific, the director Kevin Costner.
And I think we were both interested in looking at Kevin Costner, the director, because of the wild ups and downs of his career.
Mm-hmm. But even saying that, his directorial career definitely has ups and downs, but there's only three official films that have been released at the time of this recording that he directed. That's it.
As well as there is one, though, that though he did not officially direct it, it bears all the hallmarks of being a Kevin Costner vanity project.
Yes. So we'll say right off the bat, a lot of films that Kevin Costner is behind, that he produces, one could perhaps theorize or categorize them as vanity projects. Do you agree, Will?
Yes. Yes. Mm. I would agree with that. Yes.
That he is a actor that many people who have worked with him said could be perhaps a little bit difficult. And that as the director of Waterworld, who after every Kevin Costner project swears that he will never work with him again, but somehow continually does, Kevin Reynolds said, Kevin Costner should direct every film that he makes because then he'll work with his favorite actor and director.
So Kevin Costner's directorial debut, Dances with Wolves, obviously conquered Hollywood. Best picture, best director.
We're all watching it. It's still, you know, right there beside Goodfellas and Taxi Driver, right? We're spinning that Dances with Wolves.
That's a good question, because I don't know anybody who watches Dances with Wolves, but maybe you do. Maybe some of the dads out there watch it.
Dances with Wolves was never a film that I ever caught in my periphery or was shown to me in high school, which is what the film I assume was designed to be. A time filler in high school, you throw on Dances with Wolves, it's educational, right? And then you can just let the day just drip away.
But yeah, Dances with Wolves made over $400 million back when that really meant something. And it was, for Kevin Costner, the peak of an incredible run of critical and commercial success.
On a $14 million budget, it should be noted.
Between 1987 and 1992, Kevin Costner was in The Untouchables, No Way Out, Bull Durham, Field of Dreams, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, JFK, and The Bodyguard. It's no exaggeration to say that in this era, he was one of the very biggest stars.
Now, we need to discuss, for people that may be younger than us, that did not come around in the Kevin Costner is dominating everything, which would probably be the early 90s to the mid 90s. Like, who is Kevin Costner? What, in your eyes, is his persona as a screen performer? Because when you read a lot of people discuss Kevin Costner, one of the things you see thrown out again and again is that he's a bad actor. Like, that seems to surround him. And I don't know if it's something that you will agree with wholeheartedly. I will say that Kevin Costner is good at very specific things, but he also sees himself as a very serious man, which can hurt the way that he portrays his characters on screen.
Yeah, so I think I was really interested to do this episode when you suggested Kevin Costner, the director, because, yeah, as a screen presence, he's very bland. He's very all-American.
Sometimes, yes, that's what he is, right? He's like the American dad. That's like what he's going for in the majority of his films.
And yeah, when he's at his best, it's in things like, well, in The Untouchables, that really plays to the all-American side of his persona in a certain way. Like, you know, he's a Boy Scout in that movie. Mm-hmm. Or then in Bull Durham, which is probably my favorite of his performances, you know, he's a good old boy in that movie.
Or even like JFK, where he is the American dad pushed to the extreme as paranoia takes over him and obsessiveness.
So yeah, he's not like, you know, somebody like Tom Cruise has a kind of otherworldly presence. And somebody like Tom Hanks, you know, to name another of the huge box office stars of the time, he's very like avuncular and yeah, he's Jimmy Stewart. You know, he's not really handsome, but he's very pleasant and he's funny. And Kevin Costner is something else.
Now, I do want to point out that, like, earlier on in his career, that is not the role that Kevin Costner played. If you watch him in Fandango or even in Silverado, the Lawrence Kasdan movie, he plays a very kind of firecracker, loud, energetic guy. but you almost get the sense that Kevin Costner, after doing these kind of very out there centerpiece roles, went, I want to be serious, so I'm going to talk like this from now on. This is the guy I'm going to be.
That's right. In a movie like Silverado, he's very like cocky and even funny. But then, yeah, he becomes much more inward. And this is really getting at why I wanted to do this. It's like you've got this incredibly bland, like all-American guy who also develops a reputation for being a Michael Cimino level megalomaniac.
Yes.
Like after this incredible, like almost unprecedented run of popular success, he had an equally astounding run of just flop after flop after flop, including two movies, Waterworld and The Postman, that became synonymous with the word flop, just runaway productions.
As The Simpsons hilariously made the joke, hey, look, The Postman audio commentary. And it's just Kevin Costner going, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
And now, after this late career resurgence with TV's Yellowstone, which is an unapologetically, unambiguously for the dads TV show, he is channeling that into his first directorial effort in 20 years.
First directorial effort. Don't you mean four directorial efforts?
You know, a massive, at least two-part, $100 million epic that's coming out this summer.
That supposedly he basically funded himself. That, like, it's being distributed by a major studio, but, like, all the funding came from Kevin Costner, which is the case as well with most of his film productions.
Right. And so the first one, it's called Horizon, An American Saga. Again, $100 million. The first one, part one, is coming out in June 28th. The set part two is coming out August 16th. This year, they're coming out just months apart. This is a massive, massive gamble. And you see this and you think, wow, that's a man who is crazy on some level. And I want to investigate that.
And did you read the interview that he did with Francis Ford Coppola? Which is basically them talking about funding their own projects.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting because Coppola, of course, has Megalopolis out this year. I mean, God bless them both.
Costner said, you know, it was actually a small two-hander, but the more that I wrote it, it just grew and grew and grew. And I'm like, no! That's what I have to say about that.
Watching these movies, we watched the three official Kevin Costner directorial efforts, as well as Waterworld. And I was interested in taking another look at The Postman in particular, because, like, there are some legendary flops, and this was a legendary flop, a real, like, Razzie sweep kind of movie. There are some that are just too abrasive, too subversive, too full of sort of negative feeling and revisionist energy that they break a contract with the audience. And, you know, later they become praised, like Freddy Got Fingered or Heaven's Gate. And this movie has the opposite.
As opposed to The Postman, yeah, which is, hey, you know, you want something to choke down? Here's a big old bowl of oatmeal. Okay, but it's the size of a swimming pool. And it's like, I got to eat all of this? No.
Yeah, it's an amazing thing in the pantheon of cinematic flops. Like, Costner's are just too corny. They're so corny. They're so lame. They're so dad-like that they were laughed off the screen. They have such dull edges to them, but on such a vast scale.
I think going to the prototypical dad as a way to describe Costner is a great way to do it, because what is a classic dad if not someone who tells you a story and just takes way too long to tell it? Like, that defines Costner's entire oeuvre. Let's go back,
though. And, you know, Kevin Costner, just watching these movies, you can tell this is a guy who's, like, right down the middle, you know? He probably voted for George H.W. Bush in 1992 and then probably voted for Bill Clinton in 1996.
He absolutely did. Did he have golf games with Reagan in the 80s? He did.
Right. But, you know, he's also, like, you know, basically liberal enough. And I was comparing him a little bit in my head to people like John Ford or Clint Eastwood, you know, the great kind of crypto reactionary artists in cinema. And the thing is, like, Dances with Wolves was greeted as a sort of revisionist Western. It's like, here's a Western where the indigenous characters are the good guys for a change. But unlike somebody like Clint Eastwood, who is making revisionist Westerns, like, Kevin Costner only wants you to feel good.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, Dances with Wolves, I'll give this to Kevin Costner. This film, according to some sources, basically rebooted the Western genre in the 90s by its success, which congratulations, Costner, for doing that. And like you said, it has all of the best intentions that, like, hey, we're actually going to, you know, focus on indigenous population. They're going to speak in their own language. It's going to be subtitled. And somehow this movie broke through. And it's a film that no studio at this time would have funded, which is why Kevin Costner had to put up most of the money himself.
Yeah, Dances with Wolves. I had never seen it before, believe it or not.
Is it based on a book that was written by a white guy? Of course it was.
Yeah, and the question of, like, does anybody watch Dances with Wolves anymore? I would really like to know the answer to that. I would like for somebody to, like, give me proof that somebody really does watch this movie, because I don't really feel this movie having an afterlife. Like, I don't feel the issues that this movie raises really exist in the popular consciousness. You don't see people chewing over this movie. The movie doesn't, like, provoke. It doesn't bother. It doesn't raise debate, because it's an incredibly polite movie that says very little to really disagree with or feel contentious about. And it's mostly a vanity project for Kevin Costner. For all its good intentions, it is basically about Costner as the wavy haired white guy who ingratiates himself to the tribe.
Who is, like, not really personality filled, if you will. There is some dire narration in this movie where it's like, I really learned to love these people. They were very fun and filled with passion. I would say it was my greatest day I ever had throughout the film.
This movie is incredibly beautiful. Every shot looks like it's one of those paintings from the Hudson River School that you sometimes see, like at the more boring section of the Smithsonian. You know, vast landscape with the sun perfectly arranged with the clouds and the sky. And I don't know, it's crazy. Like, the movie is so beautiful and it's so boring. Like, there's so little to chew on.
Mm-hmm. It's just kind of there. And I made the mistake of watching the 4-hour version instead of the 3-hour version. And I only learned after I was halfway through that the 4-hour extended cut, which is really the only version that's easily accessible, was not even Kevin Costner's. It was the producer who did it a few years later and released it theatrically to squeeze a couple more bucks out of this bad boy.
Well, I was trying to figure out, like, why a movie that's so beautiful, why are these images, like, not moving me the way that they should? And an obvious comparison to this movie would be Lawrence of Arabia, which has a sort of similar story about, like, a white guy is welcomed into another race and becomes a sort of, like, spiritual leader for them. And, you know, Lawrence of Arabia is also full of, like, incredible, like, mind-blowing landscape shots, but there's just more, like, textural and emotional variation in them. So in Lawrence of Arabia, there are a lot of scenes that are beautiful, and then there are a lot of scenes that are fucking hot as hell. Like, there are scenes that are almost uncomfortable to look at because it's so obviously really, really hot. And in this movie, Dances with Wolves, I don't know, it's like every shot is just beautiful. And at a certain point, when every shot's beautiful, is any shot beautiful?
Shot in the beautiful landscapes of America. It's shot in Canada. That's what we're looking at, the Canadian landscapes.
I mean, the cast is good. Graham Greene, you know, is terrific to Cardinal. But I do love it that it's so funny they give Costner a white girlfriend. It's like,
oh, that is wild.
It's like the tribe, there's his white girlfriend is a white girl who is welcomed into the tribe as a baby and was basically raised as part of the tribe. And that tells you kind of everything you need to know about the political limitations of the movie, which are like, oh, yeah, well, he has to have a white girlfriend
who looks like she stepped out of the 80s with her hair and just her general look and all that. We don't want to get too wild with this kind of stuff. Yeah, that's unfortunate. I can see how people reacted to a movie like this if there is nothing around in the mainstream during this period that gave them this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And again, you know what? It's a noble effort destined to be played in high schools from 90 to about 2005. And that's where Dances with Wolves lived and basically passed away as well.
Now, the clout that he gained from this movie, which again was a massive phenomenon, led to two 90s super productions that were kind of his professional Waterloo for a little while. Why don't we talk a little bit about Waterworld?
Yeah, so Waterworld it is a Kevin Costner project in the sense that he came across the script and he attached himself to it and kind of pushed forward everything else. So like, he's a producer. He is the one pushing all these creative decisions, and it also stinks structurally and just production-wise of what he loves to do. Now, what's interesting about the documentary that was released on the Arrow Video box set of Waterworld is that, like, Kevin Costner is barely mentioned in that documentary, and it's 90 minutes long.
Wow, talk about an elephant in the room. Holy
yeah,
shit.
Yeah, lawyers kind of went through it with, a fine-tooth comb, if you will. Because, like, you do not build the whole kind of city in the film on the water unless you are Kevin Costner and you have that kind of power.
This movie, I mean, as early as, like, when I was 7 or 8, you know, I knew of this movie as being a sort of legendary fiasco. I'm sure people listening know what Waterworld is, but let's just say that in the future, if we don't stop those carbon emissions, the polar ice caps might melt, leaving the entire world beneath the water. And this movie is basically a pretty blatant, like, Mad Max Road Warrior ripoff.
Yeah, that's all it is. It's just a very expensive one. To which I say, I don't care. I don't care how much a movie costs. Like, but that's what basically the public had offense with when this movie was released.
Yeah, and, you know, Kevin Costner, he'd been, I guess, been cutting a pretty vain figure for a little while. Sometimes stars at a certain point, like, have to be taken down a peg, right?
Mm-hmm. And they also point out in the documentary that they banned the press from visiting the set, which I think was kind of like, you know, waving a red flag in front of a bull, like banning the press from the set, which made them want to like do very catastrophic write-ups before the movie even came out.
I mean, it went massively over budget. It was, I think, for a time, the most expensive film ever made. It was something like $180 million back again, back when that was a lot of money.
Yeah, like Transformers movies cost like double that amount now. So, and no one is writing giant articles about that.
Also, I just think like back then, I mean, sometimes you can see a movie a little more clear outside of the context of its release, because back then, this would have been the summer of like what? Batman Forever, like or Cutthroat Island, like audiences would have seen a fair amount of like big sets and like big jet ski stunts.
Yeah, there was no novelty to it when it was coming out. But
now,
watching it today, it's like, oh yeah, this Dumb as Rocks Road Warrior ripoff. Lots of fun stuff to enjoy in this.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's like, I wouldn't make the argument that this is like any kind of great movie or anything. I think there are times when it's a bit boring, like when it's just Costner.
Which version
like,
did you watch?
Raft.
Did you watch the theatrical version or the long one?
Theatrical.
Yeah, that's what I did. I think I watched the long one last time, and that one kind of wore at me. There's like three different, each longer than the last. It's like, nah, just stick to the 2.5 hour version. That's already too long, so.
But I would say there are like three like really good, you know, big set stunt action scenes.
Dennis Hopper's chewing up the scenery.
And that's another thing back then. Like at the time when this movie came out, people were like, oh, not another Dennis Hopper villain performance. So many, you know. It's like, fuck, I'll take a Dennis Hopper villain performance now.
But what about our favorite villains from... I can't think of anything that's been released recently that was a big budget movie that had a villain that I remember. So Waterworld, I don't think we need to spend too much time on it. This also basically came out of, it shouldn't be discounted that Kevin Costner had a massive hit with Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, which was directed by Kevin Reynolds, who made Waterworld. And that followed Dances with Wolves. So it's like the logical continuation of that. And that's another thing that like Kevin Reynolds had such a miserable time with Kevin Costner. He swore he would never work with him again after Robin Hood, and they just tricked him into doing it again in Waterworld just a couple years later. Okay, so Waterworld, not too much, you know, stuff to talk about there. Let's move on to The Postman. Boy, this movie.
Well, this is the third Kevin Costner movie in a row in which he plays a sort of a noble stranger, you know, an outsider, a lone wanderer.
Maybe he's got a few little rough edges, but his heart is made of gold and he just wants to form a family around him.
Stranger in a strange land who represents hope. And I think in particular, like at this time in his career, people were getting really tired of this.
Yeah. And The Postman I had seen when I was a teenager. And I remember liking it fine. I remember my dad liking it. So I was like, yeah, that was good. Like it probably seemed a little corny, but I went on with my life. And then the movie continued to haunt me because TBS would play it again and again and again. It's perfect filler. It's so long, they can probably stretch it out with commercials to about 4 hours long.
I also saw it with my dad on TBS, and we both didn't like it. And it was a great bonding moment. Because back then, you know, when I was 10 years old or so, I liked most movies. So it felt kind of good to dislike a movie and to dislike a movie with my dad.
Yeah, you guys were more intellectuals. We were more like salt of the earth, if you will. Kevin Costner types.
And now watching it again all these years later, I can confirm that I still don't like this movie. And I was, boy, I was really hoping to. I thought, wouldn't it be fun?
You thought there was going to be like some big twist that you're like, oh, I see what Kevin Costner was going for.
What if it turns out that this movie flopped because it was subversive in some way? It was some like...
You're expecting that from like maybe a Forrest Gump-like reading of, oh, wait, no, Robert Zemeckis is actually criticizing the boomer generation, not making a love letter to them.
So this takes place in the distant year of 2013, long after the nuclear apocalypse. All of civilization has crumbled. Most of culture has already been forgotten. There is no central government in the United States. Instead, there are communities all over the land and competing warlords, the most evil of whom is played by Will Patton. But hope emerges. There is an itinerant Shakespeare performer, a guy with a horse.
Yeah. If anyone knows Shakespeare, it's Kevin Costner.
He's got a horse and he goes around reciting monologues from the Shakespeare plays. But one day he happens upon a postman's uniform and he puts it on and he assumes the identity of a postman. And he goes to a community, sort of breaks into it, becomes ingratiated into it, inspires hope in the community. Because, Justin, I ask you, what fills you with more hope? What connects us? What binds us as a people more than the post office?
And does Kevin Costner do this by just being a con man and also sleeping with other man's wives as other African-American characters do all of the hard work? They do. He does indeed.
There are a few things to deconstruct in there. So sleeping with other men's wives. So the hit was out for Kevin Costner as being a guy who made vanity projects at this point. And this was just giving his critics ammunition. He gets to this town. He's not there for 2 hours. He's been like... claimed a local hero. Oh my goodness, the postman is here. You're telling me that somewhere over yonder there's a post office? Well, maybe America will be rebuilt. And that's when Olivia Williams and her husband come and say, he can't conceive, but we want a child. Will you be the
father? We need a super stud, if you will, to help us out.
Will you please, Kevin Costner, have sex with my wife and father my child? And yeah, I think the movie wouldn't have flopped quite as hard if they just got rid of this subplot.
Really? I don't know, man. The movie's really dull and so long.
I mean, if they'd cut an hour out of it too, I mean, good God.
It's also a very bland looking movie, like all these boring forests that we see again and again and again. And it doesn't even have that, you know, touch of beauty that Dances with Wolves has. It's just kind of like, it looks like a Canadian forest, period.
You're right. It looks like Fire Down Below with Steven Seagal.
That's exactly what it looks like. You're right. It's also a very mushy film, like structuralist in the way that it plays out, which I'm sure when Kevin Costner was writing it, he's like, ah, yes, it's very novelistic the way that it plays out. It's like, no, it's just unengaging.
That's right. At the 2 hour mark, it feels like it's about to be over. But then all of a sudden, the movie starts all over again, and you have to sit through a whole other hour of Kevin Costner, you know, being pursued by Will Patton. There's also that Tom Petty subplot where
Tom Petty plays himself.
Probably because they couldn't get Springsteen. That would be my guess. Mm-hmm. But yeah, Tom Petty appears. And I do think that, like, this is, if we're talking about just like Kevin Costner's worldview, like, I don't think Tom Petty, even in this like future dystopia, would just be like, you know, hanging out with the masses, like ready to fight on the battlefield. Like, I think some sort of aristocracy, some bourgeoisie would continue to flourish somewhere on an island. But that's not a guy like Kevin Costner isn't going to have that in his movie.
I do want to correct the boring forests that appear throughout this film. We're actually shot in the USA before anybody writes in to correct us.
But the Tom Petty
stuff, you know, I'm really surprised that Kevin Costner didn't like grab a guitar and Tom Petty's like, wow, you're teaching me licks I've never thought about before. Because that's what this, like, the kind of movie this is that ends unironically with them building a statue of Kevin Costner.
So this is an incredible, like, two-part thing the movie does. Halfway through the movie, you know, when Kevin Costner is fully, he's not a fraud anymore. He's fully becoming his identity of the postman. Because, yeah, his black sidekick, Ford Lincoln Mercury, has, while he's been off, he's actually created
doing
the post
the work.
Office.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But when Costner is finally becoming the postman, he's riding his horse and he sees a little boy run out and hold a letter in the air. And he turns around and in slow motion, he gallops his horse past the boy and picks up the letter. It's supposed to be, you're supposed to like stand up and cheer. And if that's not bad enough, it literally fucking ends with a statue of that encounter. As if Costner was like, that's the moment.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, listen, there may not be a statue, but there will be one day, like Rocky in Philadelphia or RoboCop in Detroit. There's going to be a Kevin Costner statue doing his thing from the postman. Well, no, this movie flopped. Nobody liked it.
So yeah, swept the Razzies, you know, a complete disaster. And for the next, you know, 10 or so years, Kevin Costner was just a bit of a fallen star. He was still frequently in movies, but they carried a scent of doom around them, I would say.
Yeah, but like he was in films that had budgets, but like you would see them and go, was this released theatrically or... It must have, right? Like Mr. Brooks. Actually, that's a little bit. Or 3,000 Miles to Graceland. Dragonfly. Ugh, For the Love of the Game. The Sam Raimi film. P.U.
Well, Costner had like, because some of his best movies are sports movies, there's always like every 3 or 4 years, there's a new like, Kevin Costner's back in a sports movie. It's draft day.
That's right. It's Kevin Costner making the big deals for football players. Who cares? I saw that movie at the drive-in.
It's like Moneyball for football or something.
Yeah, something like that. And so he did direct one more film in 2003, Open Range. This is the main reason I wanted to do this episode. If it was just The Postman and Dances with Wolves, I don't think I could have generated enough interest for us to do a whole episode about this.
Yeah, I saved this one for last because I suspected it might be the best one. And I was right. It is the best one.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a kinder, gentler Unforgiven.
Yeah, it's also a very small scale film, even though that you can tell that Kevin Costner probably built an entire town for what is essentially something that somebody like Bud Bedeker would have shot in like a week. And it would have been like a 65 minute movie.
I feel actually in this movie, like some of Costner's good impulses running up against some of his bad impulses. The movie is still 2.5 hours long. And again, it suffers a little bit of that, like every shot is beautiful, so no shot is beautiful syndrome. It has like a thick, syrupy musical score that's over everything, like underlining every emotion.
There's a really funny scene where, I mean, to me, in retrospect, where Kevin Costner comes across one of his coworkers and he's been shot dead. Kevin Costner looks at him and then he looks over and there's a dead dog and the music is like, no, it's like, all right, forget this guy. It doesn't matter. It's the dog that mattered. And you know what? Kevin Costner knows exactly what he's doing because that's what people react to, not the dead human.
Yeah, that's what makes him the director that he is. Now, this movie is, in contrast to those other two films, does not carry the same heavy weight of pretension to it. It came marketed as just a straight-ahead Western, not a revisionist Western like Unforgiven.
Nope.
Just a normal, like, meat and potatoes Western that's also 2.5 hours long. And on those terms, it works pretty well. Costner stars alongside Robert Duvall, who I think is very good in the movie.
I think that like this movie is helped immensely that Kevin Costner, I believe he's the POV character throughout. Like it never really cuts away from him to other people, which I don't know, could be a vanity thing. But by consequence, he spends like 95% of the movie with Robert Duvall, who's grounding Costner in a way that doesn't happen when it's just him by himself.
Yeah, and I think something about Robert Duvall brings out something good in Costner's acting. Like, Costner no longer seems just, like, wooden and bland. He seems terse and minimal when he's next to Robert Duvall.
That's what happens when you put, like, one of the greatest actors to ever work in American cinema beside a guy. That's a pretty good actor. He can do it.
And also, I think what works about the movie is that it basically has a central idea, a good Western idea that is, like, interesting and that sustains it. So like the Costner character was, you know, an expert marksman during the Civil War, killed a lot of people, did a lot of things that he wasn't proud of. And for the last 10 years, he's been working with Robert Duvall, who's this like freelance rancher, you know, this cattleman. And he's been much like Clint Eastwood in Unforgiven, been trying to atone for his sins, you know, living a good, honest life. They stumble into town, a town that's run by this evil rancher played by Michael Gambon, who is fantastic in the movie, chewing the scenery. And there is no limit to Gambon's evil. He orders them out of town, but also like he tries to like steal their horses and stuff. And he like,
well, he doesn't like that they're free grazers, that they're just grazing on public land, which is very funny because like, the people watching this movie, and probably Kevin Costner himself, would hate the idea of free grazers.
Absolutely. So, you know, the central idea is like, you know, they have to go back to town to confront Gambon for his violent behavior and the bad, you know, the bad hombres that he's employing. And over the last 10 years, the Duvall character has like forged a path of peace, and he's become a sort of like spiritual mentor, for want of a better phrase, for the Costner character. But now Costner has to say like, well, to what extent can violence be allowed into my life? If I use violence in this situation, does that define me? I don't know. It's like, it's a good Western material. You know?
It's very simple, straightforward Western stuff. And the most important part of this film is that it's a continuous line of tension that, from a genre standpoint, nothing happens for 2 hours. Like, it's just kind of like threats and, well, people get killed, but in very undramatic off-screen ways. And then the movie just lands its ending. It lands exactly where you want it to be in a satisfying way, in almost an exhausting way, too. Basically, a gunfight breaks out that lasts like 20 minutes.
And also, the love story between Costner and Annette Bening, I think it works. You know, it's
whoa,
a nice,
almost
like,
age-appropriate. That's nice.
Yeah, it's like restrained, like it's never pushed very far. It's allowed to sort of like simmer for most of the movie. And yeah, I found it affecting.
So it's almost as if like Costner in his bones can make straight ahead Western genre entertainment, but he does it so rarely that it has to be really big and grand when he does it.
Yeah, I mean, my conclusion after watching all of these movies, I was actually going into this episode kind of excited for his big 2, possibly 4-part Western that he's going to make this summer. And now I'm not excited for it because, look, he seems to want to work on a vast scale and tell like huge stories with big themes. And he's just not, I have not seen any evidence that he's that guy. He's a very normal, he's a normal guy with normal guy's insights.
Yeah.
And so
he's very corny and earnest and by consequence, kind of boring.
And so I would say, give this guy a direct-to-video budget, give him a strict 90-minute cap. And I think Kevin Costner could do a really good Western. Make him try to tell him to be the new Bud Bedecker instead of the next John Ford.
He can't, he doesn't want to do that. And someone like Kevin Costner, even if he's, you know, using John Ford as a template, John Ford cut his teeth on like 500 movies before he got to all the classics that get talked about right now.
Well, and also like John Ford had things to say that are more interesting than, isn't the Postman a symbol of America?
I'm very excited for these epic Kevin Costner Westerns. Especially that the trailer has a scene where someone goes, I just want to spend time with a good man. And then it cuts to Kevin Costner. I'm like, ah, yeah, he's back to his old tricks.
Well, I'm sure we've not seen the last of Kevin Costner on this show. I'm sure that perhaps for a Patreon episode in future.
Yeah, you said you're not excited, but you're going to see those movies, Will. I'll make sure of that.
I'll see them with you. I think we'll have a good time.
It's an event. You get to, the first one ends, you get to look forward to the next one in 2 months. So as per usual, you can send us letters to importantcinemaclubpodcast@gmail.com. This week on our Patreon, we're back to hanging out with our good friends, the Looney Tunes. But we're not seeing them at their best.
That's right. Justin and I consulted, well, we didn't consult. We found a blog post by the great animation historian Jerry Beck, where he listed his least favorite Looney Tunes cartoons of all time. And we watched them. Are these the worst Looney Tunes ever? What makes a bad Looney Tune? Only one way to find out.
Listen to the episode now at patreon.com/theimportantcinemaclub. And next week, P.U., what's that smell, Will? Oh no, it's next week's topic.
That's right. It's a golden raspberry and it's gone rotten, folks. We are zeitgeist humping by checking out the new retrospective on the Criterion channel devoted to Razzie winners. That's right, the Razzies. You know them. You love them. The Razzies are shit, obviously.
Awful.
We do not endorse them in any way, but the Criterion channel has a new retrospective where they're putting together notable Razzie nominees and winners, some of which are good, some of which are bad. And we're going to dip into those films and find some film maudits.
Yeah. Putting the Blair Witch Project on there. Come on, Razzie. That's like a slam dunk. But Freddy Got Fingered, that's interesting. Now people will watch it maybe under a different perspective. But we will not be discussing that film because we were already on the right side of history. We did an episode on the movie much earlier on in the podcast run.
But that's right. Earlier in this episode, we were talking about how, like, Kevin Costner didn't really qualify as making interesting bad movies because they weren't subversive, they're not abrasive, they're not challenging the form. But some of these Razzie winners do. So we'll be talking about Fassbender's Quirrell, William Friedkin's Cruising.
Cocktail, the Roger Donaldson movie.
Yeah, with Tom Cruise, just because I've never seen
it. Roger Donaldson is like a cursed name. Like, I'll see a movie, I was like, ooh, interesting actors. I've never heard of, oh man, Roger Donaldson.
And then maybe we'll watch, I don't know, we might watch Under the Cherry Moon with Prince. We might watch Showgirls. We'll see.
We will not be watching Geely because I just watched it for No Such Thing as a Bad Movie. And neither will we be watching Swept Away, which I also did for that podcast. Both of those movies stink. Throw them in a chest and put them out to the ocean. Thank you very much. All right, so that's what we're going to be doing next week. Until then, my name is Justin DeClue.
I'm Will Sloan.
Thanks for listening. As per usual, I'd like to thank some of our new patrons, who include Extinction Agenda, Jeff Chanley, David Munkrath, Daniel Nelson, Travis, Zach Schindler, Gold Member, Gold Member, Niami Poop, Lewis Waters, and Elliot Jones. Thank you all for becoming patrons. We could not keep doing this without you.
I'm broadcasting to you from London, Ontario, where I visited a store here called Just Heroes, I think it's called, like the comic book store in town. Had a great time there. And when I was there, I bought a Godzilla action figure. Actually, it was a Mecha Godzilla action figure, and you may be thinking, Justin, don't you have a bunch of Mecha Godzilla action figures? Yes, I do. But this one was Mechagodzilla in half transformation. So the lower half of his body still has Godzilla skin over it. And the upper half, you see the Mechagodzilla beneath. He was in disguise. And I saw that and my heart just went pitter patter seeing that on the wall. It's like, I have to have this new friend for my home.
Well, the company who put that out, Super 7, like, they know what they're doing. Like, if you stumble across a Godzilla figure out in the wild, it's probably them who did it because they've had the license forever. And they've somehow been able to get them on shelves more places than you would think. But this brings up a good question. You mentioned you have a lot of Mechagodzillas. Like, do you have a lot of toys or figures, like, laid out around your home?
I've never really made a point of collecting them except for the Godzilla ones, but I realize that over the years I have accumulated like a decent amount of little toys. Godzilla ones I like in particular.
Yeah, I love the Godzilla ones. I have a whole on top of a bookshelf, have all my Godzilla figures. I do have pretty specific rules about that so it doesn't like roll into madness, which is like they have to be pretty big. They can't be the $200 ones. That I'm not going down that like SH Figure Arts. You can get like really, really expensive ones because they're probably going to be knocked over. And if they're the expensive ones, they'll break when they hit the ground. And it needs to be characters I don't have. Like that's something important to me is that like I can't get 100 Megalons. That's too many Megalons, even though that he rules. I just need one and that's enough for me.
Well, I got to tell you, I have multiple Godzillas.
But probably in different forms, right? So that's different. That's different.
Exactly, because there's the 1954 Godzilla. You got to have him. But then also 1974 Godzilla, the Godzilla versus Megalon Godzilla. Mm-hmm. I love his face. In some ways, he's my favorite. But then just recently, I got a Godzilla versus Destoroyah Godzilla.
Where is he all orange and like, burning up?
Yeah, that's cool. He's burning up. That's cool. And then it's also like, we got those. It's like, well, I got to get the Godzilla versus Mothra Godzilla. In some way, he's like that 1964 Godzilla. He's definitive. That's when you close your eyes, that's who you think about.
So if you're like closing your eyes and going like, what do I wish I would stumble upon? I mean, I've talked about it on the show before. I would love I can never get his name right. It's the Godzilla's Revenge one.
Gabora,
yes. You know, there's not many figures of him that were made, which is shocking. You would have thought Godzilla would have been mined for everything that you could do. And there's like, they would be released. There was like a double set, which I would have loved to get, which was Gabora and a Manila that looks like really funky from the movie. But unfortunately, like, it's $1,000. I looked it up recently. Madness.
Oh, that's so cool. But listen, Gabara will come around. I would like a Titanosaurus, of course.
I think Super 7 put out a Titanosaurus. The thing is, like, I'm not a collector in general. I've said this before. People are like, but you own so many things. Is that like, I don't need a first edition. I don't need like, oh, this is the one that has silver. It just needs to look like the thing I like. And that's all I want. So like, if it was like a Happy Meal Gabara, I'd be happy with that guy. But I got to say, so when it comes to toys, I actually like them kind of big because I like to put them up on the shelf and I know they're like real solid. Like I have a gigantic Godzilla Final Wars Godzilla that I bought at like a GameStop for $15. That guy rule. I love that guy.
I also don't like, I don't order toys on the internet. I like to stumble on them in the wild. At BMV in Toronto, there's always like a toy rack.
Someone is ordering toys there.
And that's where you got like a Jackie Chan action figure, like Dragon Lord era Jackie.
Yeah. So I got that one. Yeah. BMV in the Annex. It was on their Instagram. Someone bought it and then returned it 2 days later. And I jumped right on it and I got it after that. Yeah. That one ruled. I love that Jackie action figure.
And I've never been more jealous of you than when you got that, you know?
I would love, and I sent you a link to it, that like old Jackie action figure that breaks my rules because he's very expensive and very detailed. But the idea of having an old man Jackie figure, like wearing a white coat and he has a little director's chair you can sit in. That's so funny to me that like, that's the thing is like the toys are things that I love, especially like very obscure things that I love. That's what I want. Now, you don't have any, like, I sent you links of, like, Tor Johnson action figure or, like, a Bela Lugosi or things like that.
I recently got a Bela Lugosi from BMV, Lugosi as Dracula, and specifically it's Lugosi as Dracula. I wouldn't accept any other Dracula.
Because I did send you a link of, like, what was it, a $300 statue of Bela Lugosi in White Zombie I saw in, like, a Previews magazine.
I think to some degree, like I wouldn't pay $300 for one of these. Like part of the joy has to be sort of like stumbling on it in some way.
But we would happily also have people send it to the P.O. Box address, which you can find below.
Yes,
if
please.
If you have any rare figures that you would want to send us, and we will put them up and we will discuss our love for them. So yeah, I'm trying to think of like, do I have any dream figures that I want? Like you, I don't really order too much online. I've ordered, I'm looking back at my shelf here. Yeah, I think there's only one that I bought online. All my other figures are weird stuff I found at the dollar store.
The one I've bought online was Jet Jaguar. I needed him.
Oh, were you jealous because I found that Jet Jaguar when I went with Mike Wood?
Probably. Oh, sorry. There is actually one other that I've ordered online, I realize. I ordered a Mandalorian Werner Herzog action figure from Amazon.
That's funny.
And
I like that. I
have him next to my Tony Leung action figure from Shang-Chi.
Oh, yes. I love that Tony Leung action figure. It's so funny. There's a gigantic Tony Leung.
I got that at Toys R Us. And then to complete that collection, I just need to get Otto Preminger as Mr. Freeze. And then I'll have my little like
oh,
art
he definitely
film
exists.
Shelf.
Probably like he a does. NECA figure that's like $100. I kept my eyes peeled for like a Jet Jaguar in like the pose like this. No one can see what I'm doing, but like the flying pose. Because I've seen him out or like pictures of him. So he's got to be out in the wild as well too. But as we talk about like the Godzilla stuff. Oh, you know what I would love is like I keep seeing like out of the corner of my eye like very obscure characters. Kaiju figures. For example, someone is making like a gigantic Gorgo figure, or I believe Mondo released Pulgasari figures. Like that would be fun stuff that I would want. Yeah. That's why we have to go to G-Fest, because we would just walk through the convention hall and they would all be before us and we would have to shut down. We give ourselves a 10-minute limit of like, all right, 10 minutes and we got to leave. And that's all of G-Fest for us.